Hello and welcome to Mop Bites, episode 195. I'm Elaine Giles and I'm here with my co-host Mike Thomas. In this episode, sexy socks, yellow icons, and Evernote extortion. But before all of that, we heard from Jammy. First of all, my assault on his wallet. I think I vaguely remember PDF opt-in from a past after hours, and I remember being tempted then. Maybe that will be the wallet assaulter in place of Canva. I think I saw bits of the Trump Panorama programme on a Jim TV screen, and you've reminded me to go and find it. Well, Jammy, it's definitely worth a watch. And Graham told us at the MacBytes After Hours on Friday, he'd watched it too. But back to Jammy. I've got to hand it to Canva. As awfully cringe and poorly rehearsed as the keynote was, and how messy the Affinity launch was itself, they seem to have hit a major home run. We literally witnessed a hostile chat switch from a humorous nay to a thunderous yay in seconds. And suddenly all my social media feeds are littered with mostly happy people. It's been so successful that it hit Adobe shares and now calls to question if any other competition will dare release similar software and dare to charge for it. Apple and their Pixelmator purchase anyone. Safe to say they've shaken things up. But whether or not that's for the better remains to be seen. Either way, so far, I'm very happy with the app itself. I'm with you, I'd rather have paid once for the full app, and I can see where they're going with making it free, but I can't shake the ick of the possibilities that could come from it being free. We'll just have to wait and see, I guess, hoping for the best. Even buying the app wouldn't stop Canva from sunsetting it at a later date if they thought it wasn't viable for them. So I guess this way it stops us parting with money that we wouldn't be able to get back. And wow, 3,500 for Adobe on disk. No wonder it was among the most pirated programs back when I was in school. I remember my dad buying Photoshop by itself back in the day, and even then it was very expensive. But he paid because he relied on stable versions for the designs that he did. He subscribed to them in recent years and won't entertain alternatives, like Affinity, irrespective of the price. He sees it as value for money that he pays, and for their faults, at least, they've always been consistent in their operations. I'm more concerned about the green than the ugly icon. Shrek green is just not appealing. I still can't get over the switch back to monochrome icons. It messes so much with my decaying eyes, as it does the lack of a light mode. There were colours in Finder. Oh, Jammy, were there colours in Finder? Yes, yes, there was. It was OS X Lion. This was pre-Mac OS. OS X Lion that nuked those way back in 2011. And I've been missing them ever since. Despite the outcry, Apple never did anything about restoring them. But hold that thought. More on that later. Back to Jammy. Why have you moved my cheese? I'm howling at that. My relationship with Notion was quite short-lived. As soon as Obsidian came into my life, I had an affair with them, and very quickly I was moving my belongings out of Notion's house and completely divorcing them. Great way to explain it. Fabulous show as always. See you all again on Friday, at which point I'll have turned 18. Well, yes. We did meet up again on Friday, and we didn't forget your birthday, did we? But maybe 18 stretching it somewhat? Mind you, maybe not, because, I mean, I'm only 21. Let's get on with the news. Oh, there's still a lot going on in relation to the Affinity by Canva release. I found an article by one person who liked the rebrand. I should have pinged her and asked what she was on. Apparently, this redesign took an army of designers and Canva professionals to complete. Really? You can't tell. It looks like one design challenge developer high as a kite after a weekend's code camp fueled by Red Bull on tap and no sleep. But we did witness the first point update. Expectations were high. You were disappointed. They did not add the light mode back. There's no coloured icons appeared. And those two things are what's been talked about and complained about most in terms of missing features. Now, the Finder icons were drained of colour way back 14 years ago. Yes, this is what Jammy was talking about. Jammy was incredulous. It was back in OS X Lion. It was the 20th of July. Now, that was my mother's birthday. So I can't prove this without checking my diary. But I probably spent the day moaning about the icons. OS X Lion was the OS with the leg ulcer wallpaper as well. Oh, it was ugly. That had to go. I couldn't even look at it. I've added a link to a screen capture that I managed to find from way back in 2011 that was showing the before and after of the Great Lion Colour Drain, or, as I still call it, crime. I don't get this because colour is part of accessibility. Another example, Audible drive me mad. If you've bought something, the buy button isn't there. It's an in your library button and it's black. Fair enough, I've got no problem with that. But if you mark something that you haven't bought as something you'd like to buy by adding it to your wish list, the button also turns black. So I can't tell whether I've bought it or I want to buy it at a quick glance. Why not have the library button green? Make it obvious. Canva Affinity have replied saying that they will pass all feedback on. That doesn't sound particularly promising, does it? Now, how's it going? Well, I've done a lot more work in version 3. Not exactly a walk in the park because there's been some strange goings on. The first issue I had was when I created a new file based on a template. And this template was created in version 2, I'll admit. I tried placing pages from a PDF in it. It did it. But it also added 12 additional pages. So the PDF I placed had 12 pages. Once embedded in this template file, it had 24 pages, 12 of which were blank. No amount of persuasion would stop it. I created a new file, I tried again, and it worked as expected. So there was nothing for it but to completely recreate the entire template. Once I'd done that, the new version worked as expected. The second issue was with another template. This one had a completely different issue. I have multiple assets that are picture frames with a wrap applied to them. They live in the assets panel. When I want to add an image, I drag and drop this asset on, which means I don't have to manually set the wrap. Well, the wrap just stopped working. It was only happening in files based on this second template. There was nothing wrong with the asset because if I created a new blank file, and added the asset to that, the wrap was working. Again, no amount of persuasion or cajoling made it work. So again, the only option was a complete rebuild. And yes, it solved the issue. And then you wonder where your time goes. I know exactly where it goes. Doing work twice that should only need to be done once. Now, I spend most of my time in what is now layout studio mode. And the decision to remove certain buttons makes no sense. It now means you've got to open the pinning panel, and then there's the wrapping options that are now more hidden. Now, that just makes me even more grateful for Raycast and its menu surfing feature. It's filtered by menu item title to give it its proper name, and I've mapped shortcut keys to that function because I use it all the time. I never touch the menus anymore. You can even use that Raycast option to toggle the panels on and off. I use it literally multiple times a day. Now, I need to use it even more because many of the options are not available in the immediate interface that is shown to you. The help is wrong in so many places. So, what are our hopes for the future? Well, hopefully they'll add back what they've taken away as a starting point. Light mode, coloured icons. If they could then fix what they've broken, that'd be great. And if they got the help to do what it's supposed to do rather than promise so much and underdeliver, that would be grand as well. The danger is they're probably focused on the development of the iPad app. If so, it might take them longer than we'd like it to fix what we would like fixed as a matter of urgency. And I doubt they'll ever fix the nuanced things that they've broken. Well, not unless the community make an almighty song and dance about it. So if there's something that you don't like, make an almighty song and dance about it. That would be my best advice. Now, just as we were getting ready to record, Apple pounced with a new announcement. I literally, not joking now, checked the calendar. because surely it had to be April the 1st. I must have fallen into a stupor, missed Christmas, and it was now April the 1st. Apparently not. Here we go. Apple have solved a problem literally no one had. They've partnered with, apologies if this is pronounced incorrectly, but you'll get the gist of it, Izzy Myaki, to create what they're calling an iPhone pocket. But let's be honest here. It's a sock. A $230 sock for your iPhone. I mean, we've reached peak lunacy, Apple, haven't we? You may recall the iPod sock from 2004. They were little knitted things that came in a rainbow pack for $29. Well, they're back. But now, they're luxury fashion. And they cost the same as over 2 years. 2 years of 2 terabyte iCloud storage. Here's the official line, and I'm quoting Apple here. It's inspired by the concept of a piece of cloth. Piece of cloth. That's literally what they're calling their innovation. $230 for the groundbreaking concept of fabric. Oh, but it gets better. The product description says it subtly reveals its contents when stretched. There are times I need to rein myself in and not say what I'm thinking. This would be one of those. So as we were saying, the product description says, I shouldn't say this twice, but I will. The product description says it subtly reveals its contents when stretched. So you can peek at your iPhone display through mesh. Because apparently, checking your phone in the normal way just wasn't convenient enough. My mind went straight to, hang on a minute, how does the phone not fall out of this thing? The security features? Absolutely revolutionary. There's no zip, no fastening, no closure of any kind. It's pretty much a please steal me sign for your $1,000 phone. Apple goes on to say, it expands to fit your everyday items, which is marketing speak for it's a stretchy bag. And just when you think it can't get any worse, it does. They're selling two versions, the short strap for $150 and the long strap for $230. That's an $80 price hike for what? Well, let me enlighten you. An extra 6 inches of fabric. Now, while you might find 6 inches of something extra is worth $80 to you, this sliver of fabric isn't it. Trust me on that one. Meanwhile, actual humans are asking for basic things, like phones that don't shatter when you look at them wrong, or batteries that last more than half a day, or, oh, and here's a radical thought, including a charger in the box. But no! What we get is designer knitwear for our devices. Is it sage financial sense to spend more on your phone's outfit than most people spend on their own clothes? And the best part of all of this, it's limited edition because, well, of course it is. They've clearly been learning from the Supreme Marketing Playbook. Make anything scarce enough and someone will queue for it. Now, I understand fashion collaborations. I get luxury accessories. But this is literally a sock with delusions of grandeur and a price tag to match. It's the Emperor's new iPhone case, except the Emperor paid $230 for it. I'm hoping you're as incredulous as I am. Now, the short strap design is available in 8 colours. Black, lemon, purple, pink, and then it gets silly. Peacock. That's teal to you and me. Sapphire, that's blue. Cinnamon, brown. And mandarin. That is orange to you and me. Really, orange. I wonder. Pro tip, Apple. If you have to put a description of the colour in brackets after the name of the colour, you need a better name for the colour. Now, the long strap version is only available in 3 colours. Black, sapphire, and cinnamon. You've already forgotten, haven't you? Sapphire, that was blue. And cinnamon, that was brown. Now you know what's going to happen, don't you? Some influencer will post a photo of themselves wearing five of these things. TikTok will make it a trend, and by Christmas, your nan will be knitting you one from a YouTube tutorial. But here's my prediction. In a couple of years, these will be talked about in the same way that we mention the air power mat, the one that never shipped, the butterfly keyboard, the one that never worked, and that U2 album that nobody ever asked for. Consider this your MacBytes reality check. But if you buy one, and more importantly, you are prepared to admit it, do let us know, because I'm fascinated. And guess what? I'm not buying one. I think this story follows up the last one nicely, to be honest. A couple of years ago, Evernote hiked prices by over 100%. The outcry was loud and long, but they didn't budge. They were setting everything up for the future, was their argument. Did you fall for that one? No, neither did we. This was where we were before some changes were made this week. There were three plans. A free plan, which was really limited. 50 notes, one notebook, 250 meg monthly upload, and you could only use it on one device. Then there was the paid for plans. The personal plan, which was $130 a year, that did have limits. 150,000 notes, 2,000 notebooks, 10 gig of monthly uploads, but it did sync to unlimited devices and, this is a good one, allowed you to file support tickets. You have to pay to file a support ticket. Fair enough. That's what they were doing. Then there was the professional plan. $170 a year. And again, the limit was 150,000 notes, 2,000 notebooks. Double the upload, 20 gig of monthly uploads. And it synced to unlimited devices. It included team features and offered Slack integration. Now, those prices that I've just quoted were already double the previous prices. In my case, more than double. Guess what? They've done it again. They have ditched those plans completely. They now have a free plan. Wait for this. 50 notes. That's it. Right, then we get on to the paid plans. Starter and Advanced. The starter is $14.99 if you pay monthly. So $14.99 a month, which would equate to almost $180 a year. But they're now offering that for $99 if you pay for the year. But before you get your credit card out, it's gone from 150,000 notes to 1,000. It's gone from 2,000 notebooks to 20. And now they're limiting the tags to 100, the spaces to 10, and attachments to 1,000. And adding in even more limitations. Your 10 gig storage has dropped to 1 gig. And you can only sync with three devices, but it does promise it's going to have AI when version 11 launches. But there'll be usage limits. We just don't know what they are at the moment. Then there's the advanced one. That is $24.99 a month or $250 a year. But for that one, you get unlimited notes, unlimited notebooks, unlimited spaces, unlimited attachments, unlimited device access and sync, and unlimited storage. Or at least you do, until they change all this again. So, that was a 50% increase. Or lose the ability to work. Because if you have more than the limit, you'll only have read-only access to the notes. Which is where I'm at. You may recall that they sacked me as a customer back in May. It's now beginning to make sense. They didn't want to honour the grandfathered pricing they'd promised I could be left alone on. I was paying $45 a year. The equivalent price to what I had then is now five times more than that. It seems greed knows no bounds. If you're caught in the Evernote's ecosystem, and I know some people prefer the notebook and tag system of Evernote rather than the backlinking style of apps like Obsidian, I have a potential solution for you. Completely free, I'll talk about it next time. So hold that thought while I pass over to Mike with a story that would usually involve me, but this time it's Mike.
Long-time listeners may remember a regular section in the show, Shopping with Elaine. Well, today I bring you Shopping with Mike. I'd booked a slot for a Tesco home delivery for Friday morning. I'd booked the earliest slot that I could get, which was 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. They aimed to deliver at some point during that hour. This was last week, by the way, the Friday just gone. At 7:45, I got an email. Delivery confirmed between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. One substitution and one item unavailable. The unavailable item was 7 packets of gluten-free pastry, which I needed for the sausage rolls, so that could have been a disaster. But I'd had the foresight to order extra last week. You know, technology is great, apart from when they use it against me. I can imagine there's a flag on my account. If product equals gluten-free pastry, and name equals Mike Thomas, and number ordered in the past month is greater than insert number here, then show us out of stock. Or am I just being paranoid? The substitution, by the way, was a gluten-free honeycomb cake. They were sending two of them instead of, wait for it, Kim, gluten-free Yule log. Yes, I know it's early November, but I was actually able to order a gluten-free Yule log. But then my heart sank. I read the email and they couldn't deliver it. Yes, I know, first world problems. Anyway, at about 8:30, I checked the Tesco app. You're the next delivery between 8:45 and 9:15. They always give a 30-minute slot. And yes, I know, 9:15 is after 9 o'clock, but I'll cut them some slack. It was rush hour, after all. Also, when you're the next delivery, the app has a little map on it, showing where the delivery van is compared to your house. Just like the Amazon app and the DPD app. Yes, Jammy, that's DPD Chris, your favourite delivery man. Anyway, 8:45 came and went. 9:15 came and went. 10 o'clock came and went. The location of the van on the app hadn't changed. I guessed he'd either broken down or had an accident. Because of his location, I knew he'd not gone the same way as the parcel fast van. For those who weren't at the Matt Bites After Hours a couple of weeks ago, that's the one that ended up on the riverbank. When it got to 10:30, I rang customer services. They checked the status of the order and told me the van had indeed broken down. A replacement van had been dispatched, not to me, but to where the broken down van was. But they had no idea where my order would be delivered. Luckily, there was no frozen food in the order, but there was fish and bananas and stuff that could potentially go off. I asked why nobody had contacted me, a quick phone call or a text message or an email. According to Tesco's website, that's what they're supposed to do. The lady at customer services had no answer to that one. All she could do was apologise, but she did credit my account with a £5 voucher. About an hour later, the map disappeared from the Tesco app. I got suspicious. My shopping's not coming, is it? A few minutes later, I got an email. My suspicions were confirmed. We're sorry to let you know that we're unable to deliver your order because of an issue with our delivery van. If you're able to collect it instead, you can do that today from our Earlham store. Now, Earlham is only a few minutes' drive away, but what part of not leaving the house don't they understand? The mail continued, or you can place your order again for another slot. So it was off to the Tesco website to book another slot. The only available slot was the following day, Saturday at 4 p.m. So I reserved that one, and with the click of a button, like I said, technology's great when it works, I was able to copy everything from the original order across to the new one, with the exception of the gluten-free pastry, which was, altogether now, out of stock. As far as Tesco were concerned, I hadn't changed the date of the existing order. I'd placed a new order for a different day. The new order just happened to have the same items from Friday's order. I couldn't cancel Friday's no-show order, as there was no cancel button. Tesco hadn't cancelled my order either, as I had until 6 p.m. on the Friday to pick it up from the Earlham store. So, as far as they were concerned, until 6 p.m, it was still an active order. Friday afternoon, I logged back into the website. I wanted to add a few items to the Saturday order. And guess what? the gluten-free pastry was back in stock. So I added some to my basket, along with a Yule log, which was also back in stock. Then on Friday evening, about 6:15, I was cooking dinner. My phone was, as it normally is, on Do Not Disturb. I happened to glance at my phone and saw I had a voicemail. For once, the transcript that Apple AI generated was bang on accurate, so it saved me listening to it. "Hello, Mr. Thomas. I'm calling from Tesco regarding your delivery. Unfortunately, you know we had a van breakdown this morning. We couldn't get it delivered, but I've got a driver who's going to be passing tonight. So he's going to bring it out and just hope that you're in and you can take it. Sorry for any inconvenience. Thank you. Bye." Now, normally that wouldn't have been a problem, but we were just about to eat, and then I was delivering a training session between 7 and 8. And of course we had Magpies After Hours. And you were busy too. That's why I booked a morning slot. I called the number back. I think it was a mobile. I'm guessing somebody's work phone. No reply. So I finished my dinner and called again. No reply. So I rang customer services and explained the situation. The lady I spoke to checked her system and said the order was delivered at 6 minutes past 6. "That can't be right," I said. "The voicemail was left at 12 minutes past 6. That would have meant it was delivered before I was told it was coming. Spooky." I checked the footage from the camera pointing at the front of the house. Nothing. I even went to check he hadn't left it by the front door. Nope. I was still talking to customer services at this point. She had no idea what time the delivery would arrive. I told her I wouldn't be available between 7 and 8. And in the end, she said she'd cancel the order and refund my credit card. But she couldn't contact the driver as she didn't have his mobile number. So he'd probably still turn up. But if he did, and nobody answered the door, he would return everything in my order to the store. So at 6:45, I went into the studio, which is where I deliver my training from. But I also kept my eye on the front door via the CCTV app on the iPad. Literally, bang on 7 o'clock, just as I started training, just as I said, "Hello and welcome to Excel Pivot Tables," the Tesco man arrived. The way they work, they always unload the shopping from the van, and then they carry it to your front door in big crates, and then they ring the bell or knock on the door. Now, I'd have thought it would be better to check if somebody is in before unloading, but, you know, that's how they work. Even though I'm delivering the training, I'm also half watching him via the iPad. He brought 3 or 4 crates to the front door and rang the bell. Now, I'd turned the bell off because I didn't want it to ring during my training. That was an ingenious move on your part several years ago, to wire the doorbell cable to an on-off switch, which we can control from inside the house. One press of the doorbell would be okay. We could just ignore it. But I knew if I didn't answer, he'd ring and ring and ring. That's why I turned the bell off. Yes, he could still knock, which he did, but that wouldn't disturb me or the people I was training. He must have been there for about 2 or 3 minutes, ringing and knocking. To be fair, it wasn't his fault. He was only doing his job, and so were Tesco, just trying to get a delayed order to a customer. So from that aspect, I can't really fault them. Let's move on to Saturday lunchtime. An email comes in from Tesco confirming delivery time and informing me that they had substituted the never-in-stock gluten-free Yule log with 2 boxes of gluten-free Christmas cupcakes. We'd not had those before, so I clicked on the link to have a look at them, only to find that the page on the website had no image. And that's it. At 4:30 on Saturday, over 30 hours after my original delivery slot, the shopping finally arrived.
The majority of it might have, but without the first lesser-spotted gluten-free Yule log of the year. Now I'm going to get mighty grumpy if I don't get my gluten-free Yule log. Even the honeycomb bauble cake would have been welcome. This was the substitution. But cupcakes? I can get cupcakes all year round. What I wanted was a Christmas treat. Then there was the knocking. He was hammering on the door. I get he was probably peeved we couldn't take the order in, but getting it all off the van was his decision. Why in the name of sanity would you not knock first? It reminds me of when Dad was ill. Every couple of weeks they'd send a delivery of support equipment, dressings, etc. Now, we're not talking a box of plasters here. This was copious crates of stuff. The system was that they rang you before the order arrived, in case there was no need to send it, if you're with me. A system unfortunately known as a dead man's handle. Now, this system worked for weeks, and then Dad died. I was deep in funeral arrangements, recovering slowly from the cast of thousands who had had to visit towards the end. And I can do without visitors, to be honest, particularly medical-related visitors. So hence, I was enjoying the peace. This was when the doorbell rang. Mum got there before I did. She opened the inside door. She had a peek outside and then opened the porch door. She was faced with an 8-foot wall of crates of stuff for Dad. The driver popped his head round the crates and offered to bring them in the house. She looked at him like he was crazy and with a straight face told him Dad had died 3 days before. Well, he didn't know where to look. He was last seen apologising profusely as he started backing down the path, taking his crates with him. I cannot understand. I think it's card-carrying ludicrous to unpack before confirming they should be making a delivery and that you're available to take it in. They're only making their own lives more difficult. Shall we move on to something logical like, oh, Excel?
In the previous episode of Excel Bytes, I talked about formulas, and today I'm turning my attention to functions. Some people use the words formulas and functions interchangeably. There are similarities, but there are also differences. So, what is a function? The way I describe a function is it's like a pre-programmed formula. So, just like you type a formula into a cell, you do the same thing with a function. And just like a formula generates a value, be it text or a number or a date, so does a function. Hence, some people use the words formulas and functions interchangeably. There's actually about 500 functions built into Excel. Each one has a name to identify it, plus you can build your own. One of the questions I often get asked is, which functions should I learn? And it's a valid question. Nobody can store the names and the syntax of 500 functions in their head. I think there's a core set of maybe 50 or 60 functions that are worth knowing, but to be honest, it depends on the problem that you're trying to solve. I'll give you an example. This is actually a real-life example from about 15 years ago when I was at AstraZeneca. One of the PAs came to me one day and said, "Mike, I have a list of 500 names in an Excel sheet. They're all in lowercase and I need them in uppercase. Is there a quick way to do that without retyping them?" She then said, "If they were in Word, I could do this easily. I could select the names and press Shift and F3. But that doesn't work in Excel. The names were in column A from row 1 to 500, so I selected cell B1 and typed an equals sign, because that's how you enter a function. Start the cell with an equals sign, just like a formula. Then I typed the name of the function, upper. Then I typed an open bracket or parentheses, because that's how functions are entered. Equals, function name, open bracket. Then I typed A1. Because that was the cell that contained the text to be converted. Then I typed a closing bracket, and that was it. So I pressed enter. And what appeared in B1 was the text that was in A1 converted to capitals. Then I copied the function down column B, and within a few seconds, B1 to B500 was filled with the names from column A, but in uppercase. So my point is that me knowing that function, not just its name, but how it worked, what was put between the brackets, saved that person hours of retyping. Should that PA then have committed that knowledge to memory? Maybe, but she may never have needed to use that function again. What she might have done is told her colleague, "Mike's just shown me this great time saver in Excel." And her colleague might be, So what? Because her colleague never works with text in Excel. So saying, should I learn this function? Should I learn that function? It's not an easy question to answer. It's like VLOOKUP. And yes, I know VLOOKUP has been superseded by XLOOKUP, but the principle is still the same. Years ago, and it might be true today, I don't know, but years ago, employers and managers would measure somebody's Excel knowledge by whether they knew how to use the VLOOKUP function. So you'd go for a job interview, the role involved heavy use of Excel, and part of that interview would be a short test related to Excel, or a chat about Excel. And the test or the chat would invariably include some questions about VLOOKUP. And this was regardless of whether the role required knowing about VLOOKUP. It's as if knowing how to use VLOOKUP made you an Excel god. The last job interview I attended was back in 2007, when I was interviewed for the trainer position at AZ. I had to deliver a 10-minute presentation, and the subject was VLOOKUP. And that was the subject for everyone who came for an interview, both before me and after me. I know that because I sat through several VLOOKUP presentations during my time at AZ. And I get it. It was a role for a trainer, and training Excel was part of the job. But why choose VLOOKUP? I've given you a couple of examples of functions. The upper function converts text to uppercase. And I know I didn't explain what VLOOKUP and XLOOKUP do, but if you ever go for a job interview for an Excel-related role, be prepared to talk about it. But in more general terms, as I said at the start of this piece, think of a function as like a pre-programmed formula. Its purpose is to generate a value, be it a number, a date, or some text, and then store that value in a cell. I'm not going to talk about every function, but I just want to give you a couple more examples. Suppose you need to calculate the number of working days between two dates, and we'll class working days as Monday to Friday. You can use the network days function. Within the brackets, you specify the first date and the second date, and the function does the calculation behind the scenes and puts the result, in this case, the number of working days, into the cell. Another function that you might need to use is the PMT function, and this function calculates loan repayments. So this is something that you might need to use in your personal life. You type equals PMT, open brackets, then specify the interest rate, the number of payments, and the loan amount, and it magically calculates the monthly repayment for you. So it's not really a case of learning as many functions as you can. It's a case of knowing whether a function exists that can help solve a problem. And if there is a function, what is that function's syntax? By syntax, I mean what goes inside the brackets. And by the way, when I talk about what goes inside the brackets, the technical term for that is an argument. So, for example, with the function equals upper A1. A1 is the argument. The reason I mention this is not to get all techie on you, but because sometimes you'll see an error message, and that error message refers to missing arguments or too many arguments. So you need to know what an argument is in the context of functions. Also, different functions require a different number of arguments. So whilst the upper function only needs one argument, the PMT function requires three arguments: the interest rate, the number of payments, and the loan amount. Some functions also have optional arguments, but I'm not going to get into that. To separate the arguments inside the brackets, you use a comma or a semicolon, and which you use depends on your computer's regional settings. So for the PMT function, you'd put the interest rate, then a comma or semicolon, then the number of payments, followed by a comma or semicolon, and then the loan amount. And sometimes you might need to combine multiple functions together. And I don't mean enter a function into a cell and enter another function into another cell that references the first cell. I mean actually combining, say, three functions into one mega formula, as I call it, in a single cell. That concept, functions inside functions, is often referred to as nesting. So as an example, suppose down column A, I have a list of first names. And in column B, I have a list of surnames. And the first names and surnames are in lowercase. In column C, I need to combine the first letter of the first name with the surname and convert the combined text into capital letters. To do that, I'd use the concat function, which is what's used to combine items together. I'd also need to use the left function to extract the first letter of the first name and the upper function to convert the combined text into uppercase. Now, I can't talk about functions without talking about dynamic arrays. Dynamic arrays were introduced into Excel a few years ago, and they've changed how formulas and functions work. Think of it like this. With a traditional function, you type the function name into a cell. It generates a single value, a number, a date, some text, and that single value is stored in that cell. With dynamic arrays, you enter a function into a cell, and within that function, you reference a range as one of the arguments. Suppose that range contains 20 cells and each cell contains a value. So the function generates 20 values, but those 20 values are stored in that one cell. But because Excel can't display multiple values within a single cell, those 20 values expand down the column or across the row, starting from the cell that you type the function in. And that expanding is known as spilling. There are many benefits of dynamic arrays, including the fact that you don't have to copy the formulas down or across. And it uses less memory because there's only a single formula or function. And there are fewer recalculations to perform. Spill ranges expand or contract automatically as the source data changes. So if my 20-cell range grew to 25 cells, the number of values generated by the function would grow too. Anyway, that's it for today. If you're a function newbie or you're newish to functions, I hope that gives you a better understanding of them.
And on to events. We're live again on Friday with MacBytes After Hours and our season pass. We had double do's last weekend. We had a live show on Friday and an AMA on Sunday. Oh, a great time was had by all. We restored a couple of, shall we say, challenging photos. I think the challenge got harder as we went on, but we had a great time. And thank you to those providing the images for the challenge. I'm glad you were happy with the results. So we're doing it all again on Friday night. What we're doing? Not got a clue at the moment, but hopefully I will by the time you're listening to this, or maybe a little bit later. But that was it for this episode of MacBytes. As always, we would love to hear from you. So please send your questions, comments and queries by email to thecrew@macbytes.co.uk or use the contact form on the website. We also have a very active Discord chat room that's open 24/7. Simply go to macbytes.co.uk/TMC, the MacBytes community, and join the conversation. You can follow MacBytes on Blue Sky, where we're MacBytes. You can follow me personally on Blue Sky, where I'm Elaine Giles.
You can follow me on Blue Sky, where I'm Thomas Mike.
And I'm MacBytes Siri on Blue Sky.
The full links to all those socials are in the show notes. Until next time, this has been Elaine and Mike bringing you MacBytes.
Goodbye.
Goodbye and see you next time.
How are you doing with the new affinity?
Not great, if I'm honest.
It's the new color scheme, isn't it?
Color scheme? That implies there's more than one. It's just green, violent, radioactive, soul-devouring, Shrek, green.
They call it modern minimalism.
It's not minimalism. It's a war crime against retinas.
Canva said it was all about consistency.
Oh, it's consistent all right. Consistently ugly.
The icons all look the same now.
I spent 10 minutes trying to find the inpainting brush and accidentally launched Designer, a spreadsheet, and a mild panic attack.
They said removing the colors would reduce cognitive load.
Mission accomplished. My brain gave up and went for a lie down.
They've even updated all the branding.
Updated? It looks like it was dipped in lime cordial.
Maybe it's supposed to symbolize creativity.
It symbolizes radiation exposure.
They say you'll get used to it.
Oh sure, like you get used to tinnitus.
At least it's accessible.
Accessible? I can't find anything. The toolbar looks like a Sudoku puzzle.
You think it's that bad?
I've seen more color range in a Victorian photograph.
Maybe the next update will fix it.
Only if it reinstates the color wheel and my will to live.
You do know this is the future now, right?
Then the future needs a more varied palette.
So what are you going to do about it?
I'm starting a support group, Victims of Vibrant Green, First Meetings in Dark Mode.
Will there be snacks?
Of course, avocado dip. It matches everything.